But I remember, this is very deja vu. When I was 31, I was in seminary. I went on a fact-finding tour to the Guatemalan refugee camps on the border of Guatemala and Mexico. These are people who are refugees from the civil war there. Horrible stuff. And I was taken into the camp by a guy called Brother Fidel. He was an ex-Catholic priest who had been booted out by the bishop because he was getting too close to the Indians. Kind of like deja vu for me, right? And too much like Jesus, right? Kind of according to the Bible too much. But anyway, so he was living among these refugees, right? And the Guatemalan army kept raiding across the border and killing people all the time. And kids were dying every day from malnutrition, typhus, dysentery, the whole bit. Rickets, kids running around blind, you know, nightmare. But these people were the happiest, those children and those people. They had a love I've never seen before anywhere. And when I came back to Canada, I felt it was barren. I felt like I'd come back to a dead zone because I didn't find people who were devoted to each other. They would die for each other. And they did all the time because they had nothing else. They didn't have the buffers. They only had each other. And I remember I said to Fidel one night, I said, which means faithful, I said, don't you ever get scared like what you're asking me now, right? And that was on the other side of the veil I had to go through myself, that when you go through a testing, you say, hey, I did it. I'm stronger than I realize. I'm braver than I realize. We all go through that. You know, when we've been through, we discover that warrior in ourselves, right? You can't, nobody can do it for you. You got to find it on your own. But I said to him, don't you get scared? And he said, yeah. And he said, I got in my Land Rover and drove away once. I got in my Land Rover and drove away once from the refugee camp. And then I came back and I said, so what brought you back? He said, well, whenever I get scared, I go to the poorest child in the camp and I just look at her and I realize she can't get away. And she gives me the courage to last another day.
Hello, everyone. This is Kevin Ann at Eagle Strong Voice and welcome. This is Radio Free Canada. It's a voice of the resistance and the Sovereign Republic of Canada. It's Sunday, May 4th, 2025, and once again, we're broadcasting live from reclaimed land. It was what was once called Canada. Remember Brother Fidel's words that you just heard. Whenever I get afraid, I go to the poorest child and remember that she can't get away. Then she gives me the courage to stay another day. It's all about standing by me. Stand by the one in harm's way and face down the thing trying to kill them, the thing trying to kill the innocent. That is love in action. And without it, we have no future as a people, and all our words and pretenses are meaningless. That's one of the reasons why we are relaunching this program 10 years after it was first broadcast, along with our Sovereign Republic of Canada early in 2015. Our purpose here on Radio Free Canada is to revive a fading memory of the victories we have won over three decades in exposing and stopping the crimes of church, state, and the corporatocracy, and replacing their genocidal child-killing system. But we're also here to educate and train a new generation of fighters to reclaim our minds and our world. And we'll offer you a way to understand today's events and turn our common vision into a new social reality, featuring people on the ground who are doing that. You can follow the history of this work and our substance at our sites murderbydecree.com and Republic of Canada, that's with a K, republicofcanada.org. There is, of course, always the ideal and the reality. How do we continue every day in the face of such odds? This show isn't an abstract one where we talk about ideas hanging out there in the ether somewhere. These aren't abstract issues. They involve real people. Our stories, the way we have struggled against incredible loss to bring out the truth. That's why I want to begin today and really dedicate this show by remembering the bravest woman I've ever met, Georgina Cameron from Australia, who died 2 years ago. She was first assaulted by Catholic Church goons when she stood up in a mass in Wollongong, Australia in December 2022. All she did was she read out from the statement called Crimen Solicitanus. It's a Vatican policy saying that when children are raped by a priest, no one is to be allowed to speak about it, and the police are not to be told. In other words, a criminal conspiracy to protect child rapists. Georgina stood up and began to read it, saying, "I have a duty of care as a teacher to let you know that your children are at risk." Well, that's as far as she got, because at that point, she was quickly surrounded by three men, led by the parish priest, James Arblaster. They grabbed her, they forced her to the ground, even though she was 69 years old and on crutches. And the bishop, Brian Mascord, stood there in the pulpit and watched it all. And when Georgina kept speaking out, he actually got up and left the church. But then they dragged her and threw her out of the building and damaged her arms and legs even more. It was a 69-year-old woman just speaking peacefully during the announcement time. Well, it didn't stop. Because after that, she went out and tried to recruit homeless people to come and peacefully occupy the church, as is their legal right, since the Catholic Church is a convicted child-killing organization, and under international law, they don't have the right to their own assets and property. They can be lawfully seized. And their priests arrested for complicity in that crime of protecting child rapists. And because she didn't let up, she was killed. She died in July 2022. And one of the guys who killed her and arranged it was a man called Ian Benson, who she had confronted personally, because he's a teacher at Notre Dame University in Sydney, but he's also a member of the shadowy Opus Dei cult and an advisor to the Vatican's Santa Alianza Covert Action Agency, which kills people. It eliminates anyone who starts talking about child trafficking in the church. He also, not accidentally, he was the same man, Catholic lawyer who in 1997 was hired by the United Church to expel me and blacklist me after I brought out the similar crimes against children in the so-called Indian residential schools, the death camps in Canada. Why the United Church paid a Catholic lawyer like Ian Benson $58,000 to do a hatchet job on me, that confused people for a while, but then in the light of his involvement in the murder of Georgina Cameron, it makes sense, because one thing that Georgina brought out in the course of her investigations was that the same cult that operates in Vancouver, out of the Vancouver Club, it's called the 12 Mile Club. It's part of the Ninth Circle's Child Sacrificial and Trafficking Network, and Ian Benson is an active member. Georgina found out that it was operating in Sydney, Australia, and Shanghai, China. Soon after that, she was found dead. So, what do we do with that? How do we remember her? We remember her by doing as she did. Otherwise, we're spitting on her grave. We're spitting on the graves of all those children and on the suffering of all of us who carry on. Because this isn't some abstract issue that doesn't affect you. The COVID measures were happened because the drugs were first tested on Native children, on reservations, and in the Indian hospitals and so-called res schools. The corporatocracy is based on the whole model of church, state, and big money. Tyranny that was played out against Native people for so many years, now it's hitting all of us. Like my friend Frank Ermanskin, Cree elder in Vancouver, says, well, now you all know what it's like to live on the reservation, to have special cards to travel anywhere, to get shots, whether you like it or not. It's all blowback and payback. I think it's justice. Well, he could be right. I think he is right. But I remember, in terms of heroes like Georgina, words by Walt Whitman, the American Civil War poet, when he wrote, "Brave were those who endured the storm of battle, but braver still the ones who pushed to the front and fell, unknown, unremembered." Well, we remember Georgina and many like her, and all those children on the ground and who will be killed tomorrow if we don't act. Because those monsters in robes continue to prosper and feed, while good people like Georgina who confronted them lie dead. And most people stand by and watch and allow it to happen. Well, I mentioned Georgina because her story really summarizes our struggle. And, behind this mask of evil, religion creates a perfect shelter for it. Don't forget, Lucifer means being of light, a thing clad in a robe. And I think of that now as to go to current events, this papal election going on after the death of Jorge Bergoglio. And I go into that in a recent interview I did with Sean Atwood. In England, some of you might be listening who heard that interview. And one of the things I mentioned in there is a book I recently wrote called Dethroning a Rogue Power. Right after the interview, over 200 copies of this book were bought on line from my site, but also from Amazon where you can get it. And I urge you to get it. It talks about the crimes of this beast we're facing, the kind of the source of a lot of this evil for many centuries, the thing in Rome. And so we have to be armed with knowledge before you can fight something, before we can protect our children. We have to see what we're involved in. And as part of that, at the halfway mark in this show, in a number of minutes, we're going to listen to a lecture I was to give at Oxford University with a Catholic prelate. We'll debate the issue of, is there any good in the Catholic Church? And we go into great detail about the nature of this thing, how it's been a shelter for crime over many centuries. It's kind of like the Canadian election results. Okay, the Liberals are still in and the Tories are out. Tweedledum is in. Tweedledee doesn't get its chance yet. But the point is, they're just binary parts of the same corporate system, same policies. And, you know, it makes us realize that when in Canada especially, or in any Commonwealth country, or in England or anywhere, when you vote, you commit treason. Because your member of parliament, it's not your member at all, because he's the sworn agent, not of you, or a constitution, or the law. He's the agent of Charles Windsor in London. He takes his oath of allegiance to him and nobody else. So the government doesn't serve you, it serves him. You're signing away your sovereign authority by voting in Canada. And that's why, you know, the debate of who's in, who's out is irrelevant. That's why we formed the Republic. Once Queen Elizabeth was lawfully convicted of genocide at the same international common law court case we did in Europe that also forced Joseph Ratzinger and Pope Benedict out of office, once Canada lost its official head of state, Elizabeth Windsor, as a convicted criminal, then something had to replace it. We used that opportunity by forming the Sovereign Republic of Canada in January 2015. And now you can opt out of this criminal corporate system. You can get out of Crown authority altogether. And you do that by taking out citizenship and forming a local assembly. 12 or more of you can sign a charter and form an assembly. Then you can start passing your own laws, enforcing them with your own sheriffs and common law courts. At one point in Canada, right after the COVID thing broke out, we had over 40 of these assemblies operating, and we nullified COVID orders, we reclaimed land, we kept federal tax money in our community since most of those taxes go to pay off debts to foreign banks, not to help the people. None of it was ever opposed by anyone in so-called authority, because they knew we had the sovereign authority to do that. And that's summed up in my latest book I wrote called Governing Ourselves, a handbook on personal, political, and spiritual sovereignty, which I'm going to be discussing in the second half of the show after that clip from our lecture about the nature of the beast in Rome. So all of this is important to remember because the purpose of this show, of course, is to arm people to take back their sovereignty personally, spiritually, politically. Our republic was formed for that purpose. Because we stand under the authority of natural law. You can tell in the flag, when you look at our flag, it has three stars representing the founding nations, English, French, and Indigenous. But then these blue lines, which are taken from what's called the Two Row Wampum. That was the original treaty signed between our European ancestors and the Indigenous nations of Eastern Turtle Island, what some call North America. And it said, we'll share the land together as equals. Well, that original understanding was destroyed and abrogated by the founding of Canada, but the Indigenous traditional people, not the puppet government chief and council puppet leaders, but the traditional hereditary elders who are part of our movement, they said, no, the Two Row Wampum is still in effect. And that's embodied in our republic and natural law. It's threefold belief that no one has authority over anyone else, that we are all meant to share the earth. No one has a right to more of the earth or its wealth than anyone. And we are to share it in harmony and take care of Mother Earth. It's just common sense. That universal truth is buried and embodied in our Constitution and our laws, which we've already begun to pass. So in other words, you can get out of the old system. You can join the Republic and start enacting that on the ground. We stand on that historic Two Row Wampum Treaty. And what's significant about that, too, is that it's establishing a new relationship with Indigenous people. We've signed treaties with the traditional Chilcotin, Squamish, and Cree people in Western Canada, and we're protecting each other's sovereignty on the ground. We're setting up our own schools, our own medical facilities. We're urging the police and everyone to come over to us. It's a revolution from below, from grassroots revolution happening. So again, write to Republic National Council at protonmail.com and learn not only how you can get involved in that in Canada, but how it's part of what's called the Republic Alliance Movement. And that's a movement in 9 countries now that we set up in the wake of COVID and the growing corporate police state around the world. It's our alternative to the corporatocracy. And we encourage the formation of these sovereign republics in many countries, actually in 9 countries. We have regular calls, conferences. And so this is a global movement. And it grew out of our first campaign to expose genocide in Canada, because when we learned on the ground that the courts in Canada are just appendages of the thing that killed all these people and can't not judge and bring in a fair verdict about genocide in Canada, we had to create our own courts. That's why we set up the International Common Law Court of Justice that forced out Ratzinger, that indicted Bergoglio, who just died for trafficking and killing children. And out of that came the recognition this time that we, the people, took back power if we're to even save our children. So that's a bit of that history. And in the light of that, we have to realize, too, that we're standing on the traditions of our ancestors. Because the idea of a republic in Canada is not an old one. It's embodied in everything we do every day, but it also came out of an event, December 1837, where patriots, including my great-great-great-grandfather, Philip Annett, who was a blacksmith in southern Ontario, we took up arms and we tried overthrowing British Crown authority in what is now Ontario and Quebec. And I was raised on our Annett family stories of how grandfather Philip Annett had taken the only family musket and marched off in the middle of the night in the winter to fight British Army regulars west of London, Ontario. And it's significant because when I was looking through our family archive, I found a letter from Philip Annett. And it said, it was written to our relatives back in Wiltshire, England. And he wrote, "You had best come to this country lest you all starve to death. For here in the Canadas is a land of liberty and plenty. No game wardens or lords over you, no rents to pay, rich soil that grows any crop without dung. Here we are held in respect by our neighbors. No man is over another." That's the vision, folks. But that liberty was threatened by the same tyranny we face today. They called it the Family Compact back then, but it's really a church and state oligarchy of wealth that ruled arbitrarily. In 1837, it was operating openly. And what's ironic is that rigid dictatorship of bankers, bishops, and crown bureaucrats is still in operation today. Because after defeating the rebellion in 1837, they solidified absolute authority. They created a tyranny in Canada like a feudal society, ruled over by one man, the Governor General, appointed by a monarch across the ocean, who had authority to remove the government, write any laws with his buddies in what's still known as the Privy Council. About 80% of the laws in Canada are passed. They're never even debated in Parliament. That same tyranny gave absolute power to the Catholic Church in Quebec and the Anglican Church in Ontario, and they allowed them to launch the genocide of Native people that wiped out over 90% of them across the country by the year 1900, and to turn the rest of us into serfs on the land where we don't even own the land. It's still owned by the offshore corporation called the Crown of England, the Bank of England, and all their corporate partners. Well, the point is, you only learn about this by fighting it, by having to reach out and trying to destroy your life. I felt the lash of that tyranny in my life 30 years ago when I exposed these residential school genocidal crimes in Port Alberni as a minister. My family was destroyed by it. My children were robbed from me. I was blacklisted, unable to work. But then I began to grow from that. I got stronger from it because I realized it wasn't about me. It was about the crime, their crime, of mass murdering over 60,000 Native children in these death camps. They befog us by calling them Indian schools, residential schools. And I gathered people like me around me, mostly Native. We forced the change. We occupied the churches. We forced out the apology, not these criminal bodies. After that, they tried to make it look like they were acknowledging the truth. They set up The criminals, like the serial killer setting up his own investigation into himself, the church and government that did the crime set up the bogus Truth and Reconciliation Commission, then ended up prosecuting no one, that prevented even the naming of names of criminals or the naming of the death of a children, of children, even though half of them never came back from these death camps. That's the tyranny that conquered in 1837 and still rules today. That's why we need a republic. And that republic can only be watered and seeded by our struggle to create it. Not by going on the internet and exchanging nice words. It's not about words. It's not a big Scrabble game we're involved in. This is life and death matters, and it's affecting you now. And if it doesn't affect you now, it's going to affect you soon. So now's the time to act, folks. And again, to remind, murderbydecree.com, Republic of Kanata, K-A-N-A-T-A, republicofkanata.org. And this show will be on every second Sunday. So starting today, Sunday, May 4th, then again on May 18th, the first and third Sunday of every month. And bbsradio.com/radiofreekanata. And also to remind you, some of the books I mentioned, you can get all my books on amazon.com. Just write the name Kevin Annett, A-N-N-E-T-T. And also to acknowledge my Oji Cree in-laws and Louis Daniels, one of our murdered brothers involved in the struggle, one of the nine who were killed for starting to occupy churches for their crimes, the Anglican, Catholic, and United churches. Louis Daniels gave me the name Gano Geshu E Gekedo, which means Eagle Strong Voice, and I acknowledge him for that. May this voice, and the voice within all of us trying to get out, may it all speak loudly now. And we're going to take a break and rest my voice, and we're going to listen to this debate I was to give at Oxford University that sums up Vatican crimes and why we need to keep fighting. We'll be back right after that. Good evening, I'm Kevin Annett, and tonight I'm going to give you a lecture that I was to present to the Oxford Union, which is the oldest debating society in the world. In April 2016, I was invited to come there, in Oxford University in England, and debate a cleric of the Catholic Church over the issue. Funnily enough, the topic was, is there any good in the Roman Catholic Church? Well, as so often happens on these occasions, the invitation to me was unexplainably withdrawn about 2 weeks before the event, and the debate between me and him never happened. So I thought it would be good to post online for the world to see exactly what I was going to say that night. Good evening. Let me begin by saying what a pleasant surprise it is to be able to join you all here tonight. The last time I tried to give a public talk in England, at a London rally to protest child trafficking by church and state, your privately run UK border agency saw fit to arrest, fingerprint, jail me, and then finally deport me from your country without giving a reason at all. So be that as it may, and it usually is, I especially want to thank you for having me here tonight, having the courage to have me here tonight. Tonight's topic for debate is framed rather tellingly. Is there any good in the Roman Catholic Church? And assumably by that is meant its holding company, the Vatican Incorporated. Well, the very wording of the subject's interesting because it implies that no, there isn't any good at all. Let's search for some. Of course, trying to locate integrity in a corporation is like looking for love in a brothel. So perhaps the question of tonight's debate's already been answered. My job's done, we can all go home. In any event, the title of the main event tonight is a bit confusing, beginning with the term good, which is, after all, a completely relative and morally ambiguous term. The Spanish conquistadors and their slaughter-blessing Catholic priests thought that they were doing good when they wiped out millions of non-Catholic people for their own good. The Vatican's Inquisition that barbecued and tortured to death Christians who disagreed with Rome was officially entitled an auto da fe, which means act of faith. Even the present so-called liberal Pope Francis, Jorge Bergoglio, speaks of the goodness and zeal of the Franciscan missionaries who worked to death thousands of Aboriginal men, women, and children on Catholic slave plantations in California. Well, some things never change. Bergoglio also recently pardoned some 10,000 of his own child-raping priests, no doubt in the same spirit of doing good, at least good for his own institution. Human beings, especially when goaded on and justified by religion, always adorn their crimes in a halo of goodness. I've had personal experience of what I speak about. For over 20 years in Canada, I've lived and worked and documented alongside these folks who have lived through this story, the reality of genocide in Canada, perpetrated mostly by Catholic-run Indian residential schools, where over 60,000 children died. Half of these children never came back because at the hands of the priests and nuns, they were ritually tortured, routinely starved, trafficked, experimented upon, flogged, gang-raped, and killed en masse with smallpox and tuberculosis. Not one Catholic priest has ever gone to trial for any of these crimes, nor will they. These killers are above the law as it stands now, and having had the misfortune of speaking with enough of these scum, I know that these complicit clergy are still convinced that they were only trying to do good to the little brown savages by killing their bodies to save their souls, to quote their buddy Thomas Aquinas, one of the founding theologians of the Catholic Church. So perhaps what we need to do is redefine the term good in a better way, using this simple definition. To do good means to do no harm to others and to let them be themselves. Of course, under that definition, you immediately disqualify and condemn the Roman Catholic Church, which has killed more people than any institution in human history. The Church of Rome's body count is well over 50 million corpses, ever since it was made a legal corporation by the Emperor Constantine in the year 317. All right, that may all be true, sputter the defenders of Rome. So nobody's perfect. But look at all the charitable works the Church does all the time. Isn't that good? Well, in that sense, perhaps tonight's topic for debate should have been entitled instead, Was There Any Good in Pablo Escobar, the head of the criminal syndicate known as the Medellin Drug Cartel? Because Pablo engaged in lots of charitable good works for the poor folks of Colombia, just like the Roman Catholic Church, of which he was a dues-paying member. Pablo used his ill-gotten loot to build shelters for the homeless, playgrounds for some slum kids, and soup kitchens for the hungry. Of course, that charitable money was covered in blood and paid for by the early deaths from drug addiction of the very same people he was helping, but still, he was doing some good, wasn't he? Now, my analogy between Pablo Escobar and the Vatican is more than fitting, since not only are they members of the same club, but also the Vatican Bank is heavily invested in the international drug cartels, as well as the arms and human trafficking industries that go along with it. GMO companies, Big Pharma, the biggest small arms company in the world, Beretta Limited, even dozens of online internet porn companies, all of these 100% Vatican investments pay for the goodies doled out to those deserving poor people who kiss the claw that feeds them. But let's take on directly the suggestion that the Roman Catholic Church, as the world's richest and least accountable corporation, plays a major role in providing charitable sustenance to the world's needy. Let's ask, what percentage of the Church's annual revenue actually goes towards charitable works? Well, it's an important question, not only for the debate tonight, but because the only legal basis for the Church to be exempt from paying taxes under the Law of Nations is that they must devote all, not some, but all, of their collected revenue for either the advancement of religion or charitable works. Well, right there, you cannot go to the Roman Catholic Church unless someone wants to explain what money laundering for the mafia, buying cruise missiles for third world dictators, or issuing routine bribes to politicians and governments all over the world have to do with either religion or charity. What percentage of the Catholic Church's revenue goes towards charity? Actually, less than 1%. At least in America. For tellingly, that's the only country in the world where the Church consistently publishes any of its financial records. After all, the Vatican is a closed, self-governing, totally unaccountable body, like any secret criminal society. But that inconvenient, lingering notion of a separation of church and state found in the American Constitution requires that even the Catholic Church has to create an appearance of transparency. And so, according to the U.S. government, in the year 2013, the Roman Catholic Church in America had a net revenue of $13.4 billion. And that's just in one country, where only about 15% of the world's Catholics live. By projection, the annual income of the Vatican must be in the hundreds of billions of dollars, not just from all those collection plates from those saps, but also from its massive global investment portfolio and its secret financial concordat agreements with over 100 governments that channel a regular percentage of your tax money into the Vatican Bank and all of its criminal behavior. But coming back to America, the one country where a light is shone on the murky underworld of Vatican finances, according to the same self-audit of the Catholic Church, of the $13.4 billion raked in during 2013, only 1.1% of it went to charity. But since half of that amount came from government grants to Catholic aid societies, in reality, a whopping 0.6% of the income went from the bank accounts into charities. But since those charities are mostly owned and operated by the church itself, it just means that one hand of the octopus is feeding the other. Quite brilliant, don't you think? One half of 1%, friends. The truth is that the Roman Catholic Church is not a force for charitable works. Just look at the books. It's in fact a huge criminal racket, a money-sucking corporation that kept afloat by every taxpayer in the world. Okay, so let's turn to the other basis for the church not paying a dime of taxes, the advancement of religion. What percentage of its time and money goes towards advancing its particular, and I might say extremely violent, religious creed? Less than 10%. That's the time each week a priest spends conducting prayers, masses, or catechism classes, according to the church itself, according to a statement from the Vatican's Governing College of Cardinals, who in 2014 issued an internal report concerning the training and ordination of its priests. The main job of the clergy, according to the cardinals, is the material and social upkeep of the church, guarding the building, the safeguard of its traditions and operations, and the expansion of its income and membership. Like in any big corporation. Somebody, somewhere, tell me where God, let alone Jesus Christ, enters into that whole mess. Okay, strike two. In case you didn't know, that's a baseball term. I don't play cricket. The third and final strike against the Roman Catholic Church, and you got to watch out that for that term because the word Catholic means universal, which it is not. The final strike against the Catholic Church lies in its real and not imagined nature. Once its enormous pretense and lie is pulled back and we see it for what it is historically and today. But to do so and to pierce the mental fog surrounding the Vatican Incorporated, we have to realize that the papacy is not a Christian church at all. On the contrary, it is in every respect a cult of emperor worship derived from late 3rd century Rome, not from the historic Jesus, not even from the early Christian church. This fact is crucial if we're to deal with the mental confusion of many people, atheists included, who ponder helplessly, but how can a body that preaches about the love of Jesus cause mass murder, genocide, and institutionalized child rape? Of course, the simple answer to that is that it's always the worst child rapist in town who has the most sterling reputation. The latter is needed as a cloak by any crook. The bigger the felony, the sweeter the coating. Talk, my friends, is easy, especially from a pulpit. But let's not forget what Jesus himself warned, quote, many false prophets will come in my name and say, I am the Christ. But do not be fooled. By their works, you shall know them. Bingo. By their works, you shall know them. Well, we can see the works of the papacy all too well. Conquest, brutality, just wars, genocide, inquisition, and the crushing of the human spirit. And it all began when the Roman emperors Aurelian and Constantine created the Roman Catholic Church on the murdered bones of the early Christian church. The church was an extension and continuation of that other big killing machine called the Roman Empire. Proof of this, you don't have to look any further than the Pope's official title, which is Pontifex Maximus, which in Latin means the great bridge between, guess where, heaven and earth. That was the Latin title of the emperors of Rome, starting with Aurelian in the year 275, who also assumed the title Deus et Dominus, means God and Master. One man who's become God. Well, first that was the emperor, but now today to a Catholic, it's the Pope. Christ is no longer the link to God, but a man is, elected and elevated blasphemously over humanity, even over God, by other old men in funny hats. Well, not surprisingly, every newly elected Pope is also given the title Vicari Christi, which is even more blatant. In Latin, it means the replacement of Christ, the one who replaces Christ. In black and white, it's right there. Catholicism, papism, is the replacement of Christianity, an empire of conquest and wealth relying on the means of the world and not the way of Christ. Just look at the body count. And listen to these admissions of guilt right from the horse's mouth, or I should say ass, statements from various popes down the centuries that have never been contradicted or repudiated by any of their successors. Pope Boniface, in 1302, "We declare it is necessary for every human creature to be subject to the Roman pontiff." Pope Leo, in 1520, "The pope is Christ himself on earth." Pope Pius, in 1929, "Fascism is simply the doctrines of our faith made the law in government." Pope John, in 1962, "No man may enter into Christ unless he be led there by the sovereign pontiff." Pope John Paul II, in 1996, "Have no fear when men call me Christ on earth, for I am he." Pope Benedict in 2008, "You need not go to Christ for salvation, come to me." Pope Francis in 2016, "Christ made himself sin, made himself the devil." That's new. "For our salvation. Only the church and its magisterium can claim holy infallibility." Have you had enough? I know I have. Well, is it any wonder that such a power-obsessed, megalomaniac religion makes itself unaccountable, sees nothing with its crimes, and uses the image and words of Christ himself to delude and soak its millions of dupe followers to believe that a bit of a communion wafer or a papal blessing or the right amount of cash delivered into church coffers will buy their way into heaven, as if one can? Well, unfortunately, I saw it for myself when I was last in Rome in 2011. Right there in the Vatican Museum, a display board for buying indulgences, just like out of Martin Luther's day. Special papal blessings cost you only 150 euros. The more you spend, the closer you get to heaven. Although be warned, apparently, according to the sign, apparently God prefers credit cards to cash. How right when Pope Leo in 1520 said, "This myth of Christ has served us well." Well, the most dangerous group in the world is a super wealthy cult that sees itself as God, superior to everyone, and therefore justified in doing whatever is needed to protect itself and rule the world. A cult, in other words, like the Church of Rome. What other being than a cult can operate according to a criminal policy like Crimen Solicitanus, which has been binding on all Catholics since the year 1929? That policy states that whenever a child is raped or otherwise harmed by a priest, the police are not to be told, the victim is to be silenced, and if anyone speaks of this, they are excommunicated, thrown into hell for snitching on a rapist. Clearly, the God of Rome, like the Mafia, cannot tolerate a snitch. Better instead to operate under a global criminal conspiracy to aid and abet child rapists and killers than to cost the church a lawsuit or save a child's life. Heaven forbid. And yet, despite all of this criminal arrangement, the world keeps wondering why there's so much child rape within the Church of Rome. Are we all that blind? Do we really think a lion isn't going to eat a gazelle? Well, John Acton, a British politician, said, "Absolute power corrupts absolutely." He was referring to the Church of Rome when he made that statement, something conveniently left out of the history books. The Church of Rome is absolutely corrupt, but it also corrupts whoever is near to it, like all who attend it, who fund it, who associate with it, or rent its halls, or smile on its policies, or look the other way at all its public relations gestures. All who do so partake in that corruption. And under the law of God and mankind, those human accessories are equally guilty of all its crimes. The only good that can be said to come out of this most violent, corrupt, and anti-Christ body in history is how its evil awakens people to the need for a return to the simple words, witness, and spirit of Jesus himself. A spirit that has always been the chief adversary of the Church of Rome. Jesus founded a community of called out people, a remnant not of this world, a congregation, not a church. Nowhere did Jesus speak of popes, of bishops, of rituals and ceremonies by which someone would mediate him and God to others. He said that the kingdom of heaven lay inside each of us, not outside in a communion wafer or a religious ritual. That inner kingdom of Christ alone is the guide of all true Christians, who must come out from and be separate from all these vile, false and violent churches that deny God in practice and kill children in practice. And that's the task of any deluded soul still caught in the fatal grip of Rome and its blasphemous illusions and depravities. As America's founding fathers said, we hold this truth to be self-evident. And one of those men, the second U.S. president, John Adams, said, quote, "A free government and the Roman Catholic religion can never exist together in any nation or country. liberty and popery are opposed, unquote. The nature of an ancient corporate evil like the Church of Rome does not change over time. It simply alters its appearance because it comes out of the dark ruler of this world, the one whom Jesus said, he is a lie from the beginning, for he is the father of lies, Satan. It's a good thing to free ourselves from a lie as huge as Roman Catholicism and as criminal. As freeborn men and women, we are made for the truth, and when we recognize it, our hearts and our minds breathe freely and we return to our natural sense of liberty and independence. From that place of freedom, we are empowered to take action to stop criminals in every high place, whether they be popes or presidents or prime ministers. For we, the people, are the source of all sovereignty, of government, of law, and of religion. We can and must stop and arrest and confine child-raping priests when the police and courts refuse to do so. We can and must shut down the churches that traffic children and have hidden their crimes over centuries, like the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church of England, the United Church of Canada, all of these criminal bodies. For the life of one child is more sacred than all the fanfare and rituals of any church anywhere. Well, Jesus had his own prescription for child killers. He said, whoever would harm one of these innocent ones should have a millstone placed around his neck and be thrown into the sea. Well, I wonder what Jesus would say about an entire institution that mocks God, murders with impunity, rapes and murders children, and protects those who do so. Is there a millstone that is big enough to sink such an institution? Yes, there is. It is we, the people. I thank you.
And we're back, everyone. Part two. Well, I'm going to, as I promised, talk about how to put this stuff into practice. And it comes down to sovereignty and acting on that. We're going to discuss in this last part of the show a book that's described on the website, Amazon, and murderbydecree.com. It's called Governing Ourselves, a handbook on personal, political, and spiritual sovereignty. This is like a handbook for people building our new republic and reclamation actions on the ground. Well, when she was young, my daughter Eleanor had two favorite expressions. She loved to say, you're not the boss of me, and, but why? That's because submitting to somebody else's authority or explanation of the world didn't work for Eleanor, nor does it for any of us who retain our childhood clarity. We need to know the truth for ourselves because we know ourselves to be free. So what happened? What happened to our natural liberty? Why, to quote Jean-Jacques Rousseau, is humanity everywhere in chains if we're born sovereign? And how do we break those physical and mental shackles? The issue is one of sovereignty. Well, let's start by knowing what the word means. We have to be like young, skeptical Eleanor because the so-called official understanding of sovereignty is false and misleading. Webster's Dictionary defines sovereignty as the supreme rule, dominion, or power of a leader like a monarch who's superior to others and reigns over them. Well, bullshit. That's not the meaning of the word if you dig deeper into the original word and understand what it really means. Because in their translations, the French word souverain and the older Latin word maiestas simply means self-governance. A sovereign is someone under no authority, laws, or jurisdiction except their own. Or in the words of Ian Hamilton, the rector of Edinburgh University in 2007, we do not recognize Betty Windsor as the queen of this land, nor is she welcome here, for the people of Scotland have no sovereign except themselves. Language is power. Whoever defines the words we use controls the way we think and behave. So to reclaim our thoughts in society, we need to begin by understanding sovereignty as something inherent to us. It's held by us and it's exercised by us, we the people. It has nothing to do with a single ruler reigning over the rest of us, since, as the American revolutionary Tom Paine wrote in 1776, one man rule is neither fair, just, nor reasonable. Well, real good then, as we say in Manitoba. But how do we go from knowing something to acting on what we know? How do we reclaim and establish our sovereignty as a people in the face of a corporate system that treats us as cogs in its machine? That's the purpose of this book. So what makes human beings self-governing? The simple answer is we're born that way. It's our nature to be so because we're a complete creation in ourselves. We're able to know the truth and be responsible for it. We're not born to serve or be dominated by others, for all people are created and remain equal. You know, our human intrinsic human self-governance arises from the nature of the universe. Because the substance of everything is contained with every one of its particles. That makes all of them equal to each other, not one over the other. And because of that unity, every part of creation is connected to everything else, just like every person is connected to everyone else. And all things, therefore, are placed in common for the good of all. It doesn't mean one guy grabbing tons for himself and calling himself president or king or pope. It means all of us sharing things in common. The universe and humanity is indivisible and requires the health and growth of every part. That's just common sense, common law, natural law. Call it by different things, it's the same thing. The French Revolution put it this way. No one has any natural authority over another or the right to claim more of the earth than another because it deprives others of their natural rights and sovereignty. The law does harm to no one. Okay, well, fine. That all makes sense. But look around us and we see the exact opposite going on. And because of that, people sometimes fall into despair. They say, well, what can be done about that? Well, there's three aspects we have to look at: the spiritual, the personal, and the political. And I like to put it in the sense of the soul wears no chains. And it has to begin from there. I remember Gandhi said something once to his friends and fellow people in India when he said, if we don't achieve spiritual independence from the British Empire, we'll never have true political independence. Reflected spirit, we're just the same as it. And that's something we need to remember these days. But in terms of beginning, therefore, with spiritual sovereignty, we have to make a distinction. It's a muddled word. Spiritual is often confused with religious. Spiritual comes from the word spiritu, which means breath. It's inherent to us. Religion comes from the word religio, which means to bind together, as in tying people together unnaturally, like into a single corporate body, like a church. Two very different meanings and realities. And yet, all lumped together. In essence, our spirit is born within us where our sovereignty is. I think Tom Joad in The Grapes of Wrath, that character, said, our soul is just part of the big soul that's everybody. That's another way to look at it. And when you start reclaiming that essence of who you are, you recognize that you're running up against an institutionalized evil in the world because there is something operating. You can define evil, I guess, as a force out to corrupt, degrade, and destroy humanity and separate it from this universal truth. Put another way, people are estranged from their source in God's own sovereignty by the agenda of the world, the worldly powers, which you could describe as satanic because it's all about suppressing the many for the interest of the few. That happened when states formed, because when kings came about, they came about because of churches and priests who said, bow down and give this man your crops and your allegiance and die for him in wars because, well, the gods want it that way. We know the opposite is true, and we know it's true because that spiritual independence formed America. In November 1620, after arriving on Cape Cod, the first pilgrims signed something called the Mayflower Compact. It was the first constitution in the world. It said, by common consent, we are forming a civil body politic to advance Christ's kingdom. In other words, to govern themselves and make their own laws. That first constitution was a declaration of spiritual sovereignty, which became the basis for the eventual political sovereignty of America. In other words, when they said, the old saying back then was, no bishops means no kings. And that's true. When you govern yourself in your own congregation, it means you don't have kings politically either. The people govern themselves. And even if the king goes by the name of president, who has executive power to write his own laws and everyone has to go along, that's just kingship. I don't care if Trump does it or Biden does it. Executive order is just another form of kingly rule or papal rule. So it has nothing to do with the true American republic or democracy or spiritual sovereignty. Christ's own teaching that the kingdom of heaven lies not in religion but within every one of us, that's the program for spiritual sovereignty. That inner freedom is meant to manifest not in mere worship, but in direct action to make the last first and the first last in every realm, spiritually, personally, politically. But doing that is like dropping a match on the powder keg of a society run by and for a few people who fear the sovereignty of the majority and will resist it to the death. And that's the heart of the matter. For any declaration of sovereignty by the people creates a de facto state of civil war and dual power between them and the state that it and those it serves. In other words, we declare independence, we're going to war. You may not want to accept that fact, but the state and the corporatocracy sure does. And that's why you'll get targeted right away, and that's all the more reason why we need to stand together and organize before that moment. You can run and try to hide in a hole, but it will find you. That's especially true when people declare their spiritual independence. For then, they begin to see and feel things in a fundamentally different way that cannot be contained by the status quo. They have, in the words of Sun Tzu in The Art of War, established their own ground of battle and thereby mastered the spirit or chi of their enemy by asserting their own. In a practical sense, that's how every kind of sovereignty is created and enforced, in the face of the power of the old regime and our declaration of independence from it. The way I like to look at it is spiritual sovereignty, reclaiming your mind and heart and soul, that's the axe that separates you from the old system. Personal and political independence follow from it, as does the inevitable war of independence. Now, we've summarized the nature of that struggle in one of the appendices in this book. It's 50 points from Sun Tzu's Art of War, which really talks about qi, which is strategic energy. He says, whoever masters the qi of an enemy wins the battle every time, no matter how big your opponent is. These lessons can be applied personally, spiritually, politically. And that's how we lead into the second discussion in this book, which is the people are the government, political sovereignty. And we've got a few minutes left on the show. I'm going to carry on with this, but the important point is that governing yourselves politically is an action of direct democracy, not through so-called representatives. No one can represent you. If you go back to Greece and stand on the Acropolis in Athens, you'll be at the site where direct democracy was first born 2,500 years ago. Because the Athenians, and that's the meaning of the word political, political comes from the Greek word polis, P-O-L-I-S, which means the city, but a particular city, ancient Athens, where people didn't choose representatives. They ruled directly. They gathered in assemblies and made the decisions and the laws themselves. They drew lots and took turns being the magistrate or the archon, who was the legislator. In other words, you would get the equivalent today is you'd get a notice in the mail that, hey, you're the judge this month. Come into the assembly and start helping form laws. You had to take personal responsibility for the government and actively participate in it, in these Athenian assemblies. And it gets even better because anyone in authority could be removed at any time by a majority of the citizens and assembly, if the people didn't like what the official was doing. That guy could even be banished from the city or ostracized. That's where we get the word from, because their name would be inscribed on pieces of pottery called ostracons, and they'd be gone. Well, it's small wonder that Pericles, who was an Athenian statesman, called his city the shining jewel on a hill into which all good things flow, for there its citizens dwell according to their own just and virtuous governance. Well, in the 25th century since then, that kind of direct democracy has never been matched by any political system anywhere in the world. Either through voting or coercion, every government of the world steals authority from the people and claims to represent them while ruling over them. Tom Paine said, democracy does not consist of choosing your masters, but of having none. I'll let that sink in for a minute, for those of you who want to rush out and vote and sign away your authority. Politicians and the unelected civil servants and judges who make and enforce the laws are all unaccountable and immovable. That's not democracy, that's tyranny under the guise of a electoral system. So political sovereignty then is really a natural extension of reclaiming yourself. Governance must always remain in the hands of the people for it to reflect and uphold our innate liberty. You surrender it and it's gone forever. Well, we took that to heart when we formed our common law courts that deposed Ratzinger in Rome. And every day when we sign up new people and I show police my Republic citizenship card and I ask them to join up, I've never been arrested at protests any of these times when I show them my citizenship card because they know I'm in a different jurisdiction and I tell them that. And the key to that, of course, is establishing your own laws, the importance of the assembly, and your own courts. I remember a veteran of the Republican Civil War in Ireland, Joe McKenna, said, the way we achieved independence, we established our own traditional Brehon law courts, that's Gaelic law. We established our own courts right under the nose of the British, and then we had to defend those courts in arms. So when we started living under our own laws, everything had to follow right up to becoming a new nation. And that's the point. And that's the point we're going to go into in more detail. Because like I say, every part of this show is going to be partly educational, partly training. And we're going to be back in 2 weeks, Sunday, May 18th, same time, same place. And until then, read up, republicofcanada.org. Write to us, Republic National Council at protonmail.com. And stand by to listen as well for activists who are going to be in the show on the ground who are taking the fight to the enemy. It's time to do that. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. Stay strong, stay clear, and we'll carry it on.